You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hello, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Anthony Kashevitz, and this is our latest look at the Cleveland Indians. I am joined, as I am each and every week, by Jordan Bastian. JB, you are out in Goodyear. Actually, I haven't caught up with you in a couple weeks here, so a lot to go over from the early days of spring training camp. We know not a lot on the line with the Indians in terms of jobs to be won and that sort of thing. The roster's fairly well set, but always some subplots, if you will, to the spring season. And we got an early one here with Jason Kipnis' shoulder strain that had him scratched from the lineup the other day in Cactus League play. How serious is this? What's the word on Kip's shoulder?
Yeah, I mean, we had already seen before he was shut down from the first handful of games, you know, he had been alternating sort of more aggressive workouts and then had some lighter workouts where he wasn't taking part in throwing. And Terry Francona kind of let us know early on, like, the based on previous springs, you know, when he had shoulder issues crop up, you know, they had him on a strengthening and maintenance rehab program behind the scenes. So they were trying to keep his load light. And then the other day he, before the second game of the spring, you know, he was trying to lengthen out his throwing and just felt a little discomfort in his shoulder. And they thought, due to the length of spring, you know, the one benefit this year is that it is longer than other springs. They thought it would be, you know, better to just sort of try and nip it in the bud right away. So he got a cortisone shot. He'll be shut down from throwing for 4 to 5 days, can still do some light hitting and things like that. And the expectation is that he'll be fine. I mean, Terry Francona kind of reiterated that a lot of guys, you know, when they start throwing after the offseason, you know, there will be some aches and pains as they get used to it. But with Kipnis, they know there's been issues in the past in spring of dealing with a sore shoulder. So just trying to address the issue early, and there's doesn't sound right now as though there's any expectation that this would linger deep into the spring or affect his availability for opening day.
Well, that's good because the Indians have enough shoulder intrigue as it is with right. Michael Brantley, of course, him being a big question mark here in the spring season, and it's going to be fascinating to see what he can deliver. You know, hopefully gets into game action before long. But what is the latest on Brantley and his recovery from the second of two shoulder procedures last year?
Yeah, I mean, much like last year, he's taking part in, you know, basically every facet of the workout except for stepping into the cage and taking regular batting practice on the field. He has advanced to that step in the cage. So we saw him the other day, you know, being thrown to and hitting, and that's a big step because that's when the unpredictability of the swing is introduced. Rather than having the ball stationary and really able to control the swing, you know, this now is more of a reactional phase, you know, so they're monitoring that, and he should be hitting on the field with his teammates here pretty quickly. So if you look at the timetable from a year ago, I mean, he's still well ahead of where he was at this point in spring a year ago. Does that mean he's more likely to be ready for opening day? It's still way too early to know that. You know, he still has to get to the point where he's playing in games and playing in multiple games in a row, and then they can really get that gauge on how he's bouncing back and feeling, you know, after the game activity. So that stage is still a while away, but, you know, as we have grown used to over the last 18 months, he is progressing through the early stages of his hitting program with no problems. So the Indians continue to sort of, you know, hold their breath on, you know, when it does reach the game stage of his program to hopefully have him ready a lot earlier than he was last year.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure we'll continue to ask questions about Brantley each and every week on this podcast because and a team with not a lot of roster intrigue, like we said, a lot of the spring storylines about this club center around Brantley and his health moving forward. So we'll see. Speaking of health, Bill Latson, our own Bill Latson, has a podcast here on MLB.com, and he had Terry Francona on last week, and kind of interesting stuff, just kind of talked about. We know Francona's had health issues over the course of his life and managerial career, and had hip surgery over the offseason. He's had knee issues, and he missed a game last year with an elevated heart rate. So he kind of opened up about all that stuff and just made the obvious point that, you know, should any of these health issues become a distraction to actually getting the job done, you know, that would be a point where he would step away from baseball. But obviously not at that point at the moment. But he did admit, you know, there are days where he has to kind of come in early from spring training, you know, those morning workouts and whatnot. What's your take on Francona as he gears up for another long run here?
Yeah, I mean, the one thing about Francona is he's always going to be honest and transparent. Yeah. And I think there's no denying it. I mean, the guy has had 37, 38 surgeries in his life, and we were joking around. He's like, oh, I don't even count the little ones. I'm like, the little ones? You know, like, they're all surgeries. He had a hip procedure this offseason. Eventually, he's probably going to have the other hip done. You know, every day that he sits down with us for the media session this spring, when we end, he almost doesn't want to get up because he knows when he stands up, you know, there's some discomfort. And so it's led to a lot of long shooting the bull sessions, which has been great with Tito, but not great in the sense that part of it is due to, you know, he's still recovering and getting used to the rehab from the hip surgery. So, again, I think he said it exactly how it is. If he ever reaches the point where he feels like his health is interfering with his ability to do the job, you know, it wouldn't surprise me at all if he made that decision. I mean, this is a guy who's been to the World Series 3 times, won a couple rings. You know, there's not much else to prove. He's just a baseball lifer who doesn't know anything else and wants to be here and, you know, wants to do this and, you know, missed it when he took that year off and was with ESPN and, you know, loves being back in the uniform and around the players and coaches and everything. So, again, I think obviously if it were a hindrance this year, it'd be one thing. But I think he's, you know, obviously feels like he's more than capable of you know, guiding the ship, so to speak, this year. And he signed an extension, so, you know, multiple years here in Cleveland. But, yeah, I think if it ever gets in the way of doing his job, you know, he would be the first to admit it.
All right. Well, yeah, coming off that hip surgery, he's got a lot of time to sit there and work on his lineups. So here's a way too early question for you. What can be gleaned from the Cactus opener lineup of Carlos Santana in leadoff, Jose Ramirez batting second, Frankie Lindor third? It seems like Edwin Encarnacion is, you know, penciled into that cleanup spot. How's that top of the lineup look to you?
Yeah, it's interesting because, again, like every other roster question, it seems like it all comes back to Brantley, and yeah. Also you got to keep in mind Kipnis isn't available, so that kind of changes things too. The thing he has said about Santana leading off is Francona has said he knows Carlos can handle it now, so that's nice to at least have that in the back of his mind. As far as spring lineups, you know, he's really cautioned not to read into them, especially this early, because his approach to a spring lineup is usually put the major leaguers in like the front 5 or 6 spots and then put the kids lower in the lineup and the prospects, no matter what type of prospect they are or whatever. You know, it's trying to maximize at bats. You know, Yan Gomes, I think, was batting 5th. You know, I don't think Yan Gomes probably isn't going to be the number 5 hitter once the regular season starts. But in the spring, when catchers don't play the entire 9 innings early on, you want to maximize the at bats. So you put them early up in the lineup. But it is going to be interesting because if Brantley is healthy, do you hand the keys to that 3 spot right to him again because that's where he always was? Or do you view his high contact rate as being more of a protection guy and you think of him as a 5 hitter now? If he's the 5 hitter, does that mean Santana leads off again? Where do you put Jose Ramirez, a switch hitter with a high contact rate too, who also thrived as the number 5 hitter last year? And we haven't even mentioned Kipnis, who has leadoff experience, has hitting 2nd experience and hitting 3rd experience. Or Lindor, who was the number 3 hitter all year last year. So there's a lot of combinations that Terry Francona can do, and I think if you want to start reading in the spring lineups, the time to do it will probably be the last 2 weeks, and especially the last week of spring as you start getting closer to opening day. That's when you'll really start seeing Terry Francona more creating a lineup that will be giving some hints towards opening day.
Yeah, absolutely. Not much to be gleaned from the early showings, although on the prospect front, certainly an encouraging game the other day from Brad Zimmer. Had a 5 RBI game against the Reds. He went deep the other way with a pretty effortless swing, which is good to see. I know he's not on the opening day roster radar, but barring some surprise. But what are your thoughts on Zimmer going into 2017?
Well, a couple things. First of all, talking to Zimmer, he says he's trying to fight to win the job. On top of that, the team has told him he's not fighting to win a job. So, but it's great. It's great to hear the player take that attitude, and Francona loves that. You know, and Zimmer has talked a lot about Tyler Naquin and, you know, seeing him as an example of, hey, that could be me. You never know what kind of opportunity could come up in spring. You know, a year ago, because of Brantley, because of Almonte's situation, Tyler Naquin all of a sudden had a clear path to the major league roster and seized it. You never know what's going to happen over the next 5 weeks. So I think Zimmer having that attitude is the right way to go. As far as that home run and that great debut, it was a pitch out over the plate where he got his arms really extended and really drove it to the opposite field. It was gorgeous. But it also was a great example of what he does well, not necessarily what they want him to work on for the major league level. What they really are trying to get him to work on, because he is such a big guy with long limbs and a lot of moving parts, is that inside pitch. In the major leagues, pitchers can really exploit a player like that by busting him inside. You know, they know if he gets his arm extended, he can do that. But so they really have worked with him on fine-tuning his mechanics. And, to his credit, he stuck by a lot of the mechanical adjustments they were having him work on all last year, to the point where when you look at his AAA numbers, you know, they took a hit. You know, his strikeout rate soared and things like that. And, you know, he said, you know, obviously it was tempting to go back to what was working for him in the past, you know, when he was sort of getting by on his raw ability, but he's recognizing that there are things he needs to adjust to in order to have success in the majors. So the Indians sort of look at his AAA production numbers through a different lens as a fan sitting at home looking at his baseball reference page. You know, they see a guy who was really honing in on those adjustments and trying to get them to a point where they're habit and not feeling forced. And he feels a lot more comfortable right now than he did a year ago.
Ronnie Rodriguez is named not in the realm of Brad Zimmer in terms of, you know, top prospect,
right?
A well-known name among the fan base. Been bouncing up the system for a while now, 5 or 6 years now. What can you tell us about his potential to maybe he could be in the opening day mix as a utility guy?
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, he's in camp as a non-roster guy. And one thing Francona's really talked about is when Francona came over to the Indians, you know, Rodriguez was sort of a prospect for the middle infield, and now he can sort of see the landscape. I mean, Francisco Lindor is at shortstop. He's not going anywhere. Jason Kipnis is the heart and soul of the team at second base and is signed for a long-term deal. He's not going anywhere. And Jose Ramirez had a breakout campaign and is entrenched at third. You've got a couple really good major league bats at first. So where does Ronnie Rodriguez fit into the equation? Tito really praised him for sort of trying to reinvent himself as a reliable utility guy. So over the last few years, he's bounced between second base, shortstop, third base, first base, and last year really started getting exposure to the outfield. So, you know, what Francona wants is a guy who he knows he can put in late in the game if he does some pinch hitting, you know, a guy who can go to any position on the diamond and be trustworthy. And that's why, you know, despite Michael Martinez's offensive inefficiencies, Tito really likes him, because he is trustworthy at any position you put him on the diamond. And that's what they're trying to turn Ronnie Rodriguez into. And he's really opened some eyes, you know, through what he's done over the last couple of years to turn himself into that type of option. So, you know, Eric Gonzalez is in that utility role mix as well. But Gonzalez is also kind of still considered a prospect, and they wonder if it might benefit him to play regularly at AAA, you know, where a guy like Rodriguez, who maybe projects more as that utility type, you know, maybe he's an option for the major league roster to fill that type of role.
All right, JB, last thing. You've been in Goodyear now for already a couple of weeks, and you are well accustomed to life on the road, having been on the major league beat with the Indians and previously the Blue Jays for, about a decade now, right?
This is my 12th year, yeah.
And so we wanted to ask, give us a life on the road story. Give me some takeaway from your time and your travels covering Major League Baseball.
Yeah, well, I mean, Indians fans probably won't like to hear it, but, you know, I grew up a huge Cubs fan. That didn't impact who I wanted to, you know, win last year or anything like that. I didn't have really a rooting interest as a reporter. But what's funny is, as a reporter, you get to go to all the stadiums. And Wrigley Field, it took me 10 years before I worked in Wrigley Field. So the ballpark that I went to as a kid, you know, and really inspired me to want to get involved in baseball and, you know, ended up getting me into the career path that I took, took me a decade to finally sit into that press box and sit in that dugout and, you know, kind of see, you know, how far I had come. So that was a pretty cool moment. And then, you know, that came a couple years ago. And then last year for them to play the Indians in the World Series and, you know, have that moment of covering World Series games at Wrigley Field was kind of surreal. You know, I took a couple moments to just kind of look around and enjoy it. I think that's what's kind of cool about, you know, life on the road, is it gives you opportunities to go and see things and that you wouldn't normally get to experience. Like walking through an empty ballpark is probably one of my favorite things. You know, not a lot of fans ever get to experience it. They're there with, you know, tens of thousands of people to watch a game. You know, we get to walk in, you know, when it's completely empty and silent. I think there's something kind of really cool about that. And that's, you know, being able to do that at Wrigley Field was pretty special.
Yes, it was. I got to partake in that myself, of course, and I can remember just kind of sitting there in the top row of the upper deck, just eating lunch about 8 hours before first pitch, and just kind of soaking it in. It's a shrine. It really is, regardless of how the World Series itself turned out. I want to thank Jordan Bastian for joining us. Check in with him again next week from Goodyear, Arizona. Thank you all for tuning in. This has been MLB.com Extras, Cleveland Indians edition. Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz, and this is our latest look at the Chicago White Sox. And I am joined by Scott Merkin. And, Merk, right off the bat, let me just say myself and millions of other Oscar viewers the other night, we were all shocked when Faye Dunaway opened that envelope and announced you were the Best Actress winner. I thought that was a little strange. I'm glad they snorted out that snafu there.
You know, I have, unbeknownst to many people, I have been to the People's Choice Awards, and I was standing about 5 feet away from Emma Stone, who is stunning, very, very slender and stunning. And the last movie I believe I saw at a movie theater was American Reunion, the last in the American Pie series. So I might not be the best to gauge on who deserved to win and who didn't, but I'm going to say good for Emma Stone. She deserved that. She deserved that Oscar.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. I saw my wife put on La La Land the other night for like 20 minutes, and then we tapped out. We were done. But
you guys went La La? You guys went sleeping? That was it?
No, you felt like you could. I wasn't a fan of La La Land. But happy for Emma Stone, and happy for you, Merk. You're down in spring training in Glendale, Arizona, and I know you caught up with Rick Hahn here recently, and he's, of course, been a guy whose activities were a big focus in the baseball community this winter as the start of a rebuild. And but it kind of feels unfinished. We all know Jose Quintana was talked about quite a bit, and nothing transpired from that. I know you talked to Rick about those conversations. What'd you come away with?
Yeah, I had a long one-on-one with Rick, and more will be coming from that interview in the near future here in Arizona. You know, he basically pointed out what he said before. He actually laughed because he said he's abused the word druthers during this offseason in the sense that if they had their druthers, they would have made a couple more trades after the great ones they made, you know, with the great return they got. Is never great when you trade Chris Sale or Adam Eaton, but the great return they got, they'd be happy to make more. But he had an interesting quote among many that he said, you know, there's nothing that they'd received offer-wise in terms of Jose Quintana that left them saying, man, we can't leave this on the table. You know, we're going to regret leaving this on the table. So that's kind of an interesting point. And he also pointed out that, you know, he's used this line before that all 30 teams, you know, could benefit from having Jose Quintana, and that includes the White Sox. And with Quintana's two options, that leaves him 4 years under control, and I think around $36 million. And by the time those third and fourth years come around, especially the fourth year, the Sox intend to be contenders. So, you know, he very well could be part of this mix. Now, granted, you got to do more than two trades and get seven players back to really have a true rebuild because, you know, of those seven, you may get two guys who really stand out of the group. And that's not taking any shots at any of the guys they got. It's just the facts, anyone who studies prospects. But, you know, I think what he's basically saying is they're not going to settle. And maybe some of these offers that have been out there that have been reported, oh, you know, heavy interest in this team or that team, maybe it's not the case at this point. Maybe it's another team that no one expects kind of steps in and eventually makes the deal that they can't turn away from for Jose Quintana.
And one of the guys they got in the Adam Eaton trade, Lucas Giolito, was, you know, a year ago, was one of the more talked about pitching prospects in the game. And then he had a rough transition to MLB, probably hurt his trade value. So now he's with a new organization. I know you've gotten to talk to him a little bit as well. What's his outlook for 2017?
As we tape this, I'm at the home of the world champion Chicago Cubs, and Lucas Giolito is scheduled to start against them today. So it'll be interesting to see what his results are. But, yeah, I think he felt like he got into some bad mechanical habits last year, some problems with his mechanics, and tried to do too much to fix them. He pointed out to me, I said, you know, you tried to be someone you weren't. He said that's not the case. He said he just kind of did things that he shouldn't to fix them, and that, you know, kind of snowballed the effect of the struggles. You know, I don't have it in front of me, but I did a story in the offseason from our great StatCast people about his spin rate was well below average, and his strikeouts were one of the lowest in baseball per nine for guys who had pitched at least 20 innings in the majors, and that, you know, they kind of correlate. And I think what it dictates, you can't fix spin rate, you can't work on spin rate, but what it dictates is there was something wrong with his fastball last year, and he equates that to, you know, the mechanics issues. So he's keeping it simple. Rick Renteria told us just today, as a matter of fact, before you called, that his last bullpen was great, according to pitching coach Don Cooper. So we'll see what, you know, we'll see what happens. We've heard great things about Ronaldo Lopez, who was, you know, also part of that deal along with Dane Dunning. But, you know, Giolito is that the highest prospect of that deal, and we'll see what he looks like as he applies these changes.
How about Carlos Rodon, another young arm, this one at the big league level, who attracts a lot of interest, seemed to be straightening things out at the big league level late last season. But we haven't seen him yet in Cactus play, and might not for a little bit. What's with the slow play of Carlos Rodon here in camp?
Well, it's interesting because we had a nice talk on the other. I think it was a couple of days ago where he said he's not worried, he feels great, and you guys shouldn't be worried either. As he pointed to the media, he said, "I know you guys are not getting enough sleep, so get more sleep, not worrying about me because I'm fine." So we'll see if that's the case. I mean, I assume it is. They're taking it slow. He has yet to throw a bullpen as of this taping, which is a little strange. But then again, they played Chris Sale real slow last year, and what came of that was his single season high innings pitched and his single season high in a complete game. So, you know, I think if it gets to 3-4 weeks into this and he has yet to throw a bullpen, well, then that might be a little more than the slow play. Then you say, well, what's going on? But, you know, I don't expect him to get 5-6 Cactus League starts. I think he may end up getting one or two and probably working two or three in those backfields of the minor league side where you can, you know, say, okay, we're going to throw 8 changeups to this hitter and nothing else. And you can extend an inning or you can shorten an inning where you don't have to worry about paying customers or giving up 5 runs because you went with the changeup as your only pitch that whole inning. You know, it's more focused work. So as of right now, and he said it, so you can't have any doubts because the man was upbeat and said he felt great, and we're going to, you know, go with that it's just a slow entry into spring training to maximize his innings when they really count during the regular season.
All right, sticking on the pitching conversation, a pitcher from long ago, Mark Burley's number 56, will be retired this June, and you, of course, covered his time on the South Side. Merck, what are your thoughts on that honor for Mr. Burley?
I think it's a well-deserving honor. I think he was a great pitcher. I mean, he won over 200 games. I think he won 160 with the White Sox. He threw a perfect game. He threw a no-hitter. Although I will tell you that John Dangs, who's a very close friend of Mark Burley, I once asked him what was more unlikely for him to see, Mark Burley throw a perfect game with his, 87, 88 mile-an-hour fastball, or Mark Burley hit a home run. I believe it was off Braden Looper in Milwaukee. And Dangs, without hesitation, said the home run. That was the shock. He said, have you ever seen that guy swing? He said, it's the worst swing I've ever seen. So that was more shocking thing. But just a great guy. I mean, just really beloved by everyone in the organization and a fitting honor. I have one great story about him, many great stories, but one that comes to mind is a few spring back when they were still in Tucson. He told us that he was sidelined. He had a little bit of shoulder soreness, so he missed the start, and he said it was Dutch elm disease that had caused it. So, you know, we all kind of knew that Dutch elm disease happens in trees, but I have to admit that a couple of us went to the computer and Googled just to make sure you couldn't have Dutch elm on your shoulder. That night I went out and into some Tucson Kmart, and shockingly, they didn't have any medicine for Dutch elm disease out in here in Arizona, so I got him some fertilizer left on his chair and wrote, you know, hope this helps the Dutch elm disease. He got a big kick out of that. But good-spirited guy, wasn't a big fan of being the center of attention, yet was one of the best quotes I've covered in the 15, 16 years I've done this. So it'll be a great honor for him. It could be the shortest acceptance speech when a number is retired, but it'll be to the point and funny as always.
Well, as you mentioned, Merck, 15, 16 years of doing this, we're asking our reporters this week for stories from life on the road. You've got a lot of them from all those years of traveling experiences. So give me a great Scott Merkin life on the road story. I know there's got to be something.
Well, I have one good one just to keep it recent and relevant from spring training. And this is from the it certainly could be worse, so stop complaining, but it is kind of funny that first week I got out here, I got a call from my credit card company that said there was a charge that was disputed, and they were right. It was not my charge. So credit card fraud to start the spring training trip. Then a couple of days ago, I'm up in the press box, and one of the parking lot attendants, very nice guy who I'd never met before, it took him a while to find me, and he came up, and he tapped me on the back, and he said, hey, I just wanted you to know your car got hit by a tow truck in the parking lot. And I looked around for the media relations guys, one of the other reporters, and I thought, this is a really bad practical joke, and I'm not going to be happy if it's a practical joke. And I'm like, after saying you're kidding 11 times, he said, no, I'm not. I walked out. Sure enough, the right side of the trunk had been caved in by a tow truck. And if that is an irony, a tow truck totaling your car, that's it. And then on top of that, that same day, I was supposed to go with a friend to see the great Chris Rock, comedian, at a local theater in Arizona late that night. And I got an email as I was finishing working. Chris Rock was sick, and he would not be performing that night. So I hit the trifecta. I also got an email yesterday that where I live, there was a pipe burst near my place. But I lucked out on that one. I feel bad for the others. That did not hit me. So that's the okay. That's the good part. I will say one other thing is that one of the great stories in the row, without being specific, is just the people you meet. I've had some great friends that I've kept over the years who I talked to on a plane coming back from Anaheim at the World Series, or I sat with, you know, at a restaurant afterwards watching the Hawks in Tampa in the Stanley Cup after the Sox had played the Rays that day, who I'm still friends with to that day. So that's just, you know, part of the fun is just meeting the people on the road. It's not like you work in kind of like an enclosed setting where you don't, you know, you're ushered out afterwards. It's cool to meet the people who come up and talk to you and, you know, express the good things and the criticisms they have about your work and the team, for that matter.
Oh, absolutely. And yeah, Merck, I don't know if there was a black cloud following you around, but certainly I'm going to stay away from you when I come
here. Yeah, be careful. You've talked to me now, Anthony. You're going to be in Arizona soon, I'm guessing. So I would, if we do a podcast live, maybe you want to still do it by the phone from another room.
Yeah, I think we'll keep that on a teleconference. I think that's going to be best for everybody. But I want to thank Scott Merkin for joining us and sharing those stories. And thank you all for tuning in. This has been MLB.com Extra, Chicago White Sox edition. Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz, and this is our latest look at the Detroit Tigers. And I'm joined by Jason Beck. Beck, I was down in Lakeland a couple weeks ago, saw the renovations to, I mean, it's just unrecognizable. The Tigers clubhouse, you know, that whole area is totally different. And Joker Marchant Stadium obviously is a huge upgrade over what it once was. The 40-some million dollars pumped into that place really shows. What were your impressions of the Tigers' new spring home? New old spring home, I should say.
You know, it really got a pretty good facelift. You know, the new facilities for the players, I mean, it's light years ahead of where it was, and I think it catches them up with other teams and then some. You know, the clubhouse is arguably nicer than what they have in Detroit, which will be interesting to see if they have to make a similar move for their clubhouse there. And they added a weight room that I think has got to be one of the largest in all of spring training, if not baseball overall. Huge, like, two-story facility. I mean, it doesn't encompass two stories, but it's that high, you know, with equipment. I think part of the deal with that is that they want injured players to be able to begin their rehabs down here and have all the equipment they need at their access before they start picking up the rehab assignments elsewhere in the minor leagues. The fans so far, it's, you know, seating-wise, it's an interesting mix. You know, they added some cover to the seats to try protecting the sun, which has been an issue in recent years. But they also added some areas for groups on the outfield, you know, party deck in right field, you know, the berm with a bar area out there in left. And they have a concourse that basically goes all the way around the stadium, which I don't think they've ever had here before, which, you know, is odd as that may seem. But it was a big, I think as Al Avila said, you know, it was kind of like the Beverly Hillbillies going from, you know, moving on up into luxury.
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously a longstanding relationship there with the city of Lakeland, and great to see that relationship continue here moving forward. And then that's a ballpark that just has so much history to it and is now up there, you know, as far as amenities go for the average casual fan going to check it out. So certainly recommend that. And, you know, unfortunately, with the passing of Mike Ilitch, you know, there's a new ownership look now with the Tigers as well. But it stays in the family with Chris Ilitch taking over. I know you and the rest of the Tigers beat crew had a chance to catch up with Mr. Ilitch here recently to get his thoughts on the transition. What's the expectation here? Is it going to be business as usual with the Tigers? Is there going to be some kind of major change as a result of Mr. I's passing and the handing over of the torch, or what do you expect?
Yeah, the way that Chris Ilitch was talking, it should be a continuation of what their plan has been for a while now. He talked to the players Friday morning, and then he talked with us, and what he said was that the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, and that he shares his father's passion for baseball. I think the Tigers have been, you know, in some ways planning for this over the last few months. I think some of this factored into the way they were proceeding over the offseason. Was that, you know, I think regardless of Mike Ilitch's health, the days of spending over the luxury tax probably weren't going to continue. And that factored into what they were doing in terms of, you know, at least looking into some off-season deals and seeing what they could get for veterans and trying to get younger. From what Chris Oates was saying, he's on board wholeheartedly with Al Avila's plan for investing in player development and trying to build talent from within. So from that same point out, there's going to be any drastic change of course. I think they do intend to see what they can do with this team this year and see if they can win one in Mike Coach's honor, even though they couldn't do well as well.
Well, let's shift from the big picture to the small, Beck, and looking at the lineup construction for 2017. The Tigers don't have a true or obvious number two hitter. What are your thoughts on Nick Castellanos potentially batting in that second spot?
You know, it kind of reminds me of one of Jim Leland's old tricks as a manager. One of the things he liked to do, even though he didn't do it full time, was every so often he'd put a power hitter up in that two spot just to provide a little bit of punch. There's an idea he said he stole from Tony La Russa. You'd see Marcus Thames back in the day batting up there sometimes. I think sometimes Brandon Inge would bat up there. Maybe some other guys over the years. I think Castellanos fits that. I also think part of it would be an upside play. He's a guy that I don't think gets enough respect for what he does in terms of contact aside from home runs. He's a tremendous line drive hitter. He's had one of the best line drive rates in terms of centering the ball, really, you know, in the American League, if not all of baseball, over the past couple of years, even though he hasn't had the average to go with it. You buy into the idea that there's more room for growth after what he did last year before the hand injury, then I think you could easily see him taking advantage of an increase in strikes as you would see, in theory, batting in front of Miguel Cabrera. And he wants to do it. He was the guy who went to Brad Ausmus and said he wanted to be considered for it. They're batting Victor Martinez up there right now, but that's more about getting him as many at-bats as they can without having to play him a ton before he goes off to World Baseball Classic. I think we'll get more of an idea what Ausmus intends to do with that spot later on in spring as we start seeing a little bit more reflective batting orders. I think Castellanos is going to be considered. Justin Upton will not be considered. Danny Martinez will not. I think Jose Iglesias wouldn't mind doing it, although I don't know if, given his on-base percentage, if he would be the leading candidate or not. So if you go by that field, I think Castellanos has as good of a chance as anybody to take that spot.
Tigers had their first injury of camp with Tyler Collins, and I'm just wondering, how does that impact that center field position battle? Obviously, it's the most interesting position battle the Tigers have going on. So how does that affect Collins in that regard?
Osmond says it doesn't affect it very much, if at all. He's still going to be able to hit. He can still run. So what he's been doing the last couple of days is pinch hitting for the DH, in most cases Victor Martinez, and then staying in the game for an extra at-bat that way. The one thing he can't do right now is throw. That extreme lat injury is up around his armpit. So he says he can still swing a bat fine, and so far he's looked that way. And he can still run, of course. I think once you start getting closer to minor league games getting underway, you might see him playing some center field and camp games under the guise that he wouldn't be throwing the ball back into the infield. I don't know if he would flip the ball to one corner guys or what would happen there. But unless it lingers beyond the 10 to 14 days that they're saying they expect it to, I don't think it's going to have a drastic effect on the center field mix at camp, although it does give an opportunity for Mikey Matuk to get more starts out there and maybe lay a claim that he deserves more than what would look like going in to be more likely a platoon role.
All right, Beck, so you're a traveling man. You've been on the road covering the Tigers quite a bit in the last decade plus. We want to ask you give me a favorite story from the road. What's a story that kind of sums up life on the road for Jason Beck?
Wow, favorite story from the road during all my exotic travels around the American League Central, huh? One favorite trip, and it certainly was abnormal, but there was the series in Pittsburgh in 09. For some reason, the Tigers and Pirates have matched up in their league often enough where it feels like an annual trip. And their series in 09 in Pittsburgh seemed to fall right around, it was right around the time that the Stanley Cup Finals were going on between the Penguins and Red Wings. And while the Tigers and Pirates were opening their series in Pittsburgh, the Penguins and Wings were playing game seven, I believe it was, in Detroit. But the Penguins ended up winning that game. I mean, the games were going on at the same time. And I remember I was staying at the Marriott across the street from where the old hockey arena was. And I went downstairs to the restaurant for breakfast. And the weirdest scene, we're in there, and all of a sudden there's a big commotion going on. And in walks Dan Bylsma, who's the Penguins coach at the time, and he's got the Stanley Cup with him. And he's got hotel staff and coach and everything posing with the Stanley Cup. And mind you, I grew up in Pennsylvania. I grew up a little bit outside of Pittsburgh, so I grew up a Penguins fan. And so I end up getting a picture with Dan Bylsma with the Stanley Cup. And I get back to Detroit, you know, I've got it on my phone, and I've got a friend who actually played college hockey with Bylsma. So I send him the photo. He gets it printed out, sends it to get it signed by Dan Bylsma, and sends it back to him. So I've got a signed photo of me and the Stanley Cup, which, by the way, is as heavy as it looks. It was crazy.
Yeah.
I can do it. I even just, you know, holding part of it with Bylsma, I couldn't believe I could hold it up. I'm not a strong guy. And I've got that somewhere in my collection of photos. And it was so odd because I'm just, you know, I go down to breakfast and, like, you know, shorts and a T-shirt, think I'm going to go out for a run afterwards. I end up getting a photo with the Stanley Cup. Just crazy.
Very cool. Right place at the right time. And, you know, one of many great stories to begin at a Marriott breakfast. We know that well in the baseball writing community. So I want to thank Beck for sharing that one. Good one, Beck. Thank you all for tuning in. This has been MLB.com Extras, Detroit Tigers edition. Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz, and this is our latest look at the Kansas City Royals. I'm joined by Jeffrey Flanagan from Surprise, Arizona. And Jeffrey, one topic that's come up quite a bit with the Royals here in the early going is the thought of who might be extended, if anybody. Eric Hosmer, I think it was pretty well assumed throughout the winter that if they were going to make an effort with anybody, Hosmer would be probably number one on their target list among their pending free agents. After Danny Duffy, of course, who was already nailed down. But can you just tell us how realistic is that? It doesn't sound particularly realistic, but what were your thoughts on Eric Hosmer's long-term future?
Yeah, I talked to him briefly after the story came out, and you know, he emphasized not once, not twice, but three times his desire to at least test free agency just to see what it's like. So I would be surprised if something got done. You know, you've been around baseball a long time too. Those things can change in a heartbeat. But you know, he talked a lot about, you know, being in the league and service time and earning the opportunity, like all players do, to have a chance at free agency. It doesn't mean he's not going to, you know, come back to the Royals at some point, because Alex Gordon did the same thing a year and a half ago and tested free agency and then re-signed with the Royals. But I think, to a lot of players, and Oz is in that group, they just kind of want to test it to see what it's like, to see what their value is out there. So could a deal happen? Yeah, but I'd be surprised, and I think it's more likely right now that he sees what he can do this year, because he certainly could increase his value if he has a monster year in terms of a long-term deal.
Another guy who would be very valuable in free agency a year from now if he has a big year is Mike Moustakas. But he's, of course, coming off the knee surgery. Just how's he feeling? How's he looked so far in spring training?
So far, pretty good. I mean, you know, he's, as a matter of fact, I just talked to him yesterday about him trusting that knee, his right knee coming back from ACL surgery. And he's making all the normal movements, all the lateral movements defensively. He's fine at the plate. He had to duck out of an inside fastball in live BP the other day, and that locked up the knee, and he was a little scared, but then it was just fine. So all those type of baseball moves he's making and getting more confidence all the time. And they'll take it slow with him this spring. I think he's going to DH quite a bit the first week or so and kind of alternate between third base and DH and get days off. And with this extended spring training, because the WBC, they got more games, more time. So they got plenty of time to get him ready by April.
Kyle Zimmer is, of course, a name we've heard bandied about in the Royals system for 5 years now, since he was taken fifth overall in 2012. Haven't seen him at the big league level. He's had a share of injury issues and had thoracic outlet syndrome surgery last year. But he made his Cactus debut with the Royals the other day. Got roughed up a bit, but just seeing him out there is encouraging, given the injury issues that I just mentioned. So what's the status of Zimmer as spring progresses here?
Yeah, I thought he looked pretty good, actually, especially the first inning. His first inning of work, he was hitting 95, which is the old Kyle Zimmer. And he did give up an 0-2 home run, pitching an 0-2 fastball that he left middle. He was trying to get up and out of the zone. And the other hits off of him, there was a bunt single, a bloop single, and he walked a guy. There was an error, a wild pitch. It was kind of a messy inning, not necessarily a poor inning by him. Poor couple of innings. The only concern was his velo went down a little bit the second inning, down to 90-91. He kind of attributed that to that being his first up and down of the spring. And he said as time goes on, his arm will react a little bit better to those up and downs, and it'll kind of teach it to trigger it, to wake it up, as he said. And he thinks his velo will be just fine. So I think that just kind of raised a concern to us when that velo dropped, because that's exactly what happened last year at this time. I started out, throwing 95, 96, and then it just kept going down and down and down until they had to shut him down. But he said he's feeling really no discomfort, no pain. So we'll just kind of see how it goes as spring goes on.
Another very, very early takeaway from the Cactus League, Peter O'Brien, who was a low-profile trade acquisition for the Royals over the winter. He went deep in his Cactus League debut last weekend. I know he's not necessarily on the Major League radar, Major League roster radar for opening day or anything like that, but what's the future hold for O'Brien in this organization?
Well, it's worth the flyer. I mean, I think a lot of teams are just really intrigued by this power. Ned Yost told me a story the other day that, he was Tony La Russa had told Dale Swaim that he'd seen two kinds of guys with the power that O'Brien has, that the other guy was Mark McGwire. So that says a lot right there. He puts on quite a show in BP, let me tell you. It's worth watching, whether he'll be at Omaha or wherever he'll be this year. But take the time, if you can, out there and watch him hit BP, because it's pretty impressive. He can hit home runs to any field, and they are monster shots. Now, can he make the 25-man roster? Can he crack it? I don't really see a spot for him right now. But what if the guy comes up and hits 15 home runs in spring training? Well, you kind of create a spot for him then. So we'll just see how that develops too. But an intriguing figure. Things didn't quite work out for him in Arizona, but he's going to get a second chance here with the Royals.
Yeah, I remember a year ago he had the StatCast measured a exit velocity on one of his home runs at like 119. It might have been a little bit of a hot gun there in Scottsdale, but but nonetheless, impressive power there from O'Brien. So
I think that's still the longest or the hardest hit home run in StatCast history, isn't it? Something like that. So.
Yeah, I think they might have had to recalibrate the machines after that one. But Jeffrey, what's with the idea of Alex Gordon playing all three outfield spots? How realistic question? How realistic is that would be a factor in the regular season to see him in a spot other than a traditional spot?
At first, you kind of laugh at it, but, they're going to try a lot of different things this spring and maybe a lot of different things in the regular season just because they don't know what kind of right fielder Jorge Soler is going to be. They're going to try Soler and left a couple times and flip-flop them all around. And Gordy might even play some center field just so they have some versatility. I think that's going to be the theme of this camp, is that you're going to see guys in all kinds of crazy positions. Chester Cuthbert starting at second base today. Cologne's at third. You're going to see maybe Cuthbert at first a little bit. Hunter Dozier, one of their top prospects, who has really hardly ever played first base in his life, is going to be playing a lot of first base down here. So speculate away about that decision, too, in terms of Hosmer and everything. But it's just what they're going to do. Ned's going to, and his coaching staff are going to flip guys all over the place. And by the end of spring training, they'll have a pretty good idea of who fits where. That's, like I said, that's just going to be the theme. They're going to try to get a lot of guys and see how versatile this roster is going to be.
All right. Well, Jeffrey, you'll be there in surprise for the duration of spring training. You, of course, follow the Royals on the road as well. And this week we're asking our reporters to share a story of life on the road. I'm sure you've got quite a few of them, but give me a favorite road story.
Well, I can tell you this one now because I can laugh about it now, but it was not funny at the time. But last year down here in spring training, I've always had a habit over the years of, I'm not a big guy to iron clothes. So, I think an old girlfriend taught me this trick of, hanging your shirts up in the
bathroom and turning the, you know, the hot shower on and just let the steam, you know, get rid of the wrinkles. So I've been doing that forever, I think. And, well, in Arizona, for some reason, when the maids come to your rooms, they plug the little plug thing in your bathtub because they don't, because there's some kind of creature called desert roaches that sometimes get through the pipes and come out and scare the patrons or whatever. So all the maids do that. And I just, that day, I just forgot to pull the plug out. And so I closed the door and the hot water's going. And I think the Royals made some kind of roster move at that point. So I run back to my computer and I sit down and I start to write the story and completely forget about the water running. And of course it overflows and I'm on the second floor and it overflows into, you know, a couple of rooms in my place and floods the room and floods the room down below me. And oh my God, it was an absolute mess. And the final butcher's bill was $1,200, I think. And it became a great story in camp last year because Ned Yost heard about it and was relentless kidding me about it, and some of the other coaches too. So it wasn't funny at the beginning, but you know, a year later now I can laugh about it.
Yeah, the statute of limitations is up. I gotta laugh because I mean that's my move as well. Anytime I get to a hotel, I take all the shirts out, hang them up in there, and run the shower. And I've totally forgotten many times myself. Not to that point, not to the point of major physical damage, but certainly the point of a very wet floor. So I gotta be a little more careful moving forward here. But
I learned my lesson.
Oh, good stuff, Lanny. Always appreciate your time. Thanks for having us. Thanks for listening to us, everybody in the Royals fan community. We'll check in again with Jeffrey next week. This has been MLB.com Extras, Kansas City Royals edition. Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz, and this is our latest look at the Minnesota Twins. And I'm joined by Rhett Bollinger down from Fort Myers, Florida. And Rhett, just kind of catching up on some of the early news and notes from down there in spring training camp. And Byung-Ho Park has been a very early, I don't know, surprise is the right word, because, you know he has power potential, but certainly a pleasant early storyline there for a guy who was designated for assignment and then outrighted to the minors, was not claimed by another club. So he's kind of in this weird, awkward spot with the Twins, but nice performance so far. He's gone deep a couple of times, and we have to see what the rest of the spring holds, but certainly an encouraging early sign for Park.
Yeah, it's definitely an encouraging sign for Park. You never know how he's going to handle that, you know, being designated for a sign right before spring training. You know, last year was tough on him his first year, you know, coming over from Korea. Didn't go as planned. Still some of that power early, but, you know, had a hand injury, was optioned at AAA. Finished the year, you know, injured. And to get DFA, you never know mentally how he's going to take it, you know. It's tough on him. They just have to go through all that. And sure enough, he came in, and so far, he's had the right attitude. And certainly, it's definitely paid off in terms of his production. I mean, two home runs already in his first three games. He also hit the fence in right field in another one that actually some people in the Twins think was a home run as well. So it's been impressive. The big thing, too, is of the first home run was on a 93-mile-per-hour fastball, and the one that he hit today on Monday was on a 96-mile-per-hour fastball. So we know last year one of the things he kind of struggled with was velocity. And so to see him do well against high velocity like this and hit the ball, you know, with that kind of power is a good sign. Obviously, the difference is in spring training. It's so early. A lot of guys are throwing only fastballs. You're not really mixing in their full arsenal fully yet. So it's hard to really, you know, take too much from it. But the fact that he's catching up to fastballs thrown that hard and hitting the ball that hard, obviously, for home runs is a good sign. And we'll see he's definitely in the mix there for that DH job. Not being on the roster certainly doesn't help his case. I think Kenny Vargas being on the roster makes him a little bit more of a favorite. But so far, Park's been the most intriguing and best player in camp.
Well, let's talk about Vargas a little bit because, the DH spot is one of those – it's actually one of the few spots of roster intrigue with the Twins. Much of the position player group is settled. Vargas is a guy who a lot of us were kind of intrigued by at the end of 2014. I think we were calling him Little Poppy at that point for the David Ortiz comparisons, but had a rough go of it the following season. And then, last year maybe worked himself back on the radar a little bit in a short big league stint. So, what's his roster potential here?
Yeah, it's kind of the door's kind of open for him, more so than probably ever has been before. At least open a season. He's definitely got a real chance here to be the everyday DH. It kind of depends on how he does this spring, and certainly Park is going to kind of play into that as well. But the chance is there for him. You know, he's a switch hitter with a lot of power. You look last year, he had some pretty solid numbers at the major league level. Even if you look a little deeper at some of the StatCast numbers, see how hard he hit the ball. He's, you know, one of the league leaders team leaders in terms of exit velocity and all that. Him and Park both had actually some encouraging underlying stats you could see from Statcast. And the big thing too with Vargas was, you can see, is that his launch angle, or really, you know, just more than anything, he's just driving the ball into the air a lot more last year, and that was on purpose. Because the year before, for some reason, he kept driving the ball into the ground, and it wasn't really making use of his power. And once he changed that launch angle and it goes how strong he is, he was able to hit the ball into the air for home runs. And so I think this offseason has been more of an emphasis as well. He's even worked with Manny Ramirez a little bit in the Dominican in terms of, you know, kind of working on balance and getting that, you know, swing plane to lift the ball into the air and take advantage of the fact that he's such a big, strong guy. Because, you know, even a guy like Ortiz, you might see him finish that uppercut as a big lefty and just drive the ball into the air. And I think that Vargas is big enough and strong enough to do that as well. I think more and more teams and more people are starting to look at Statcast and look at exit velocity and look at launch angle and try to create the perfect recipe for hitting home runs and that kind of thing. And I think a guy as big and strong as Vargas and can hit the ball as hard as him, you can take advantage of that. And I think the fact that he kind of did that last year was a good sign. And I do think that he has some serious power potential, and just as does Park.
Another guy looking to bounce back, a young guy looking to bounce back after a rough go of things at a formative stage of his career is Jose Barrios. Had, you know, strung up the ERA north of 8 and 14 starts last season. Another guy we were high on going into last season. What do you think his chances are for that fifth starter job, and what did he learn about himself from that rough year in 2016?
The thing about Barrios is, we know the stuff is good. We saw it with our own eyes. The guy's got great stuff. He throws hard. He's got a great breaking ball. The changeup certainly has good movement as well. But last year he was hit hard. As you said, his ERA was about 8. You know, his fastball command was a major issue. Falling behind hitters, and then the changeup was crushed by hitters. And I think there's a little bit of a worry that maybe he was, you know, tipping pitches a little bit. I think the big thing was when he kind of, as part of his windup, he kind of like has his arm kind of go behind his back a little bit. And I think what happened was, too, is you could see, the hitters could see, if his pinky was up off the ball, then it was going to be, you know, a changeup. And it was, or sorry, it was off the ball, I think it was going to be a two-seamer. It was on it, the changeup. So hitters could kind of tell what he's going to throw at his, I think. So I think they kind of worked to change his delivery a little bit of his arm path. To get better consistent results. And I think that, you know, he had his first appearance in the Grapefruit League on Sunday, threw 2 innings, did give up a run, but looked a lot sharper. Because I said, the stuff's definitely there. It's just a matter of kind of harnessing it. So I think the thing he's kind of learned is just to kind of, you know, just how important, you know, fastball command is. And I think this spring, one of the big drills they've been doing is, you know, every time they throw bullpens, they got to throw 3 out of 5 strikes each side of the plate on fastballs there. So I think kind of just working that in and kind of harnessing what he has, it's going to be key for him, and he's got a chance to make the, you know, rotation. I think Trevor May is probably his top competition for that fifth spot. You know, Tyler Duffy's in that mix, Ryan Vogelsong. There's a lot of names you can throw in that spot, but I do think that the two top candidates are probably Barrios and May. And Barrios is going to pitch in the, you know, WBC for Puerto Rico, so he's got a chance to make an impact there as well. And if he pitches well on a big stage, that also could help his cause as well.
We know Phil Hughes is in the rotation, assuming health, and he's coming back from that thoracic outlet syndrome surgery and has the rib to show for it, kept the rib from that procedure. Give me the outlook for Hughes here in the early days of camp.
It's good right now. It really is. You know, talking to him, the nice thing is about surgery is thoracic outlet syndrome. Is, you know, didn't really, you know, it wasn't like he had elbow surgery or shoulder surgery. Obviously, he lost his rib, which is a weird thing. But really, you know, his arm and everything, he said it's still totally normal. If anything, obviously, it feels better than it did because, you know, when you have that injury, you kind of lose feeling for your hands, that kind of stuff. You get numbness. It feels like you almost have a dead arm every day you throw. So I think to have him feeling good and healthy is a good sign. And he's also coming off a knee injury, too. I think his last game he pitched before his Grapefruit League debut was a game in which he got hit on the knee by a line drive and fractured the knee, you know, bone above his knee. So he went through a lot last year, but the good news is he's fully healthy now. He's in good shape. Everything else, his stuff looked good against the Red Sox in his debut. So you definitely can pretty much pencil him in the rotation, barring some sort of setback. But at this point, like he was saying, he was pretty much cleared at the end of last season. He was throwing, you know, he was playing catch. He wasn't off a mound, but he at least finished last year healthy to a degree. And so he had a pretty normal offseason. So I think they're not too worried about Hughes. I think they're more worried about, you know, Perkins and his coming back from his surgery than Hughes at this point.
Hey, Red, one real sad note from the early days of camp. Minnesota journalist Rod Simons passed away at spring training camp. I just wonder if you had any thoughts on Rod. I'm sure you got to know him a little bit in your time there, but boy, what a difficult thing to have happen, you know, during spring training.
Yeah, it really was. It was very sad. Rod was an incredible guy. One of those people, you know, that was always positive and happy. You know, it seems like people are always energetic and always happy to be there, and you could really see it, you know. He came down to spring training, and we all saw him you know, that Saturday, and he was out there doing interviews with Paul Molitor and everything, because he's kind of a fixture locally on the radio. He's a former local ABC sports anchor. He used to be for, I believe, 5 years in the Twin Cities market, and been doing a lot of radio stuff over the years. And just the joy he always had on his face. You know, even the last photo they had of him was him taking a big selfie with Paul Molitor and everybody and just having a great time. You could tell he's one of the people that really loved what he did, which is refreshing to see, you know. And so to have him come down here, pass away in his sleep at 56 years old, and have a wife and a kid back at home, an 11-year-old, is really, really tough. And so it's definitely was a sad, sad day, you know, in Twins camp. And, yeah, the Twins are trying to do what they can to support that family, because it's definitely really sad news from a guy that was such a great person and a big part of this, you know, reporting community and the Twins community as well.
Yeah, all of us in the baseball community send our best to the Simons family. That's just awful. On a lighter note, Rhett, wanted to ask you, as a guy who's done his share of traveling on the baseball beat over the years, covering the Twins, do you have any favorite stories from life on the road? We're collecting favorite stories from our reporters this week.
That's a great question. I think for me, it had to be one of my first road trips. So I was hired to cover the Twins in 2011. This is my seventh season now. But when I was hired in 2011, I was based out of Los Angeles, where I'm from. And so I got the job during spring training. So it was kind of a crazy time to get the job. So I came to spring training, went on my first road trip to New York and Toronto, or Toronto and New York that year, and then came back to Minnesota for the first time ever. First time I've ever been to Minnesota was, you know, for opening home opener at Target Field. And then I had to cover that, and I had pretty much 10 days from there to kind of figure out where to live in Minneapolis. It was kind of a crazy time. Had everything kind of, I got it all figured out, had my stuff shipped. And sure enough, the day before the road trip, I was supposed to get there so I could unpack everything. Sure enough, the truck was a day late, and so I left for that road trip with all my stuff, not even there in Minnesota yet. And that first day on the road was in Chicago, and I'm kind of already scrambling because of all the, you know, craziness of the new job, and my stuff wasn't in my place yet and all that. So I get to Chicago, and it's Francisco Liriano's pitching against the White Sox. You know, and right around maybe the fourth inning or so, or fifth inning, I'm like, okay, you know, Frankie's typical Liriano. He's kind of all over the place. But you look up at the scoreboard, a couple of his riders are like, he still hasn't given up a hit yet. So he kind of laughed it off because he'd already probably thrown like 70 pitches by then. And all of a sudden, next thing you know, he just starts mowing down hitters. And we're like, okay, well, he's got a real chance here. What's going on here? And sure enough, Liriano finished that no-hitter, which was, you know, fun to watch. And it was one of the more unlikely ones. I think he walked like seven guys that day as well. So just one of those games you wouldn't forget. And also just the backdrop of it all, being my first, like, official road trip from Minnesota to a new city. And just the fact that, you know, all the craziness of my life at the time with stuff shipped to my place and covering my first no-hitter right away was definitely something I'll never forget. And it was an awesome experience. But at the time, was certainly a very nerve-wracking day. And that season, too, was fun to cover. You know, Jim Tomei's 600th home run in Detroit is a moment I'll never forget, and being able to share that and see it with how excited he was with his family to be there as part of that as well. So that's, you know, that's always kind of fun to look back at some of these historic kind of moments you see, whether it's a no-hitter or a big thing like Jim Tomei reaching a milestone like that, are always kind of the cool moments, at least in terms of the games, and sometimes the craziness of being on the road, too, also intersects with you know, your travel life and just your life at home and trying to adjust. So it's definitely, kind of crazy.
It's never normal. If it's normal, you're doing something wrong, you know?
Exactly. Yeah,
and it always comes at you in waves, those experiences. So that's a good one, Rhett. Thank you for sharing that. Thank you for your time. And thanks, everybody, for tuning in. This has been MLB.com Extras, Minnesota Twins edition.
MLB.tv Premium, the number one live streaming sports service, is celebrating 13 years. Watch every out-of-market regular season game live or on demand in true HD. Real-time highlights, live look-ins, pitch tracking widget, and more. MLB.tv Premium includes a free At-Bat 15 subscription. Watch live baseball on over 400 mobile and connected devices. Watch at home, in the office, or on the go, every night, on every device. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Visit MLB.tv for details.